Picture a city at maybe 3 in the morning.
Just complete darkness.
Exactly. Complete darkness. Most of the grid is powered down. The streets are totally empty. And in 4 different houses on the exact same street, 4 different people are asleep in their beds.
Right.
And we need to look incredibly closely at these 4 sleepers, because what is happening inside those 4 specific bedrooms is, well, it's going to unlock everything we discuss in this finale.
It really is. I mean, it serves as this ultimate foundational entry point.
Yeah.
Because if you were to walk into those houses, right, wake each of them up and just ask them what they're experiencing, all 4 of them would give you the exact identical answer.
They'd say they were dreaming.
Exactly. They would say, I am having a dream. But structurally, fundamentally, the phenomena occurring in their minds are just entirely different from one another.
So let's walk through the doors. In the first house, we have a man who ate this massive, heavy, intensely rich meal right before he went to bed.
Oh, man. We've all been there.
Right. So his physical body is entirely overloaded. It is struggling to digest this dense brick of food. His temperature is rising. His heart rate is elevated.
Yeah, the body is basically sounding an internal alarm.
Yes, it's sending up distress signals. But because his conscious mind is powered down in sleep, those raw physiological signals arrive at his brain as pictures.
Right.
So he dreams he's trapped inside a furnace. He dreams of suffocating, of this dreadful, inescapable heat pressing in on him from all sides.
That's terrifying.
He's tossing and turning, and to him, the experience feels so real. But, and this is key, this dream carries absolutely no profound message from the cosmos.
Not at all.
It is literally just his stomach talking to him in the only visual language it has available.
Yeah, it's sheer biological noise. I mean, the body is just screaming, and the mind is hastily painting a picture to represent that screen. There is no external truth being accessed there.
Okay, now consider the second house. Here we have a sleeper who, throughout their waking life, is a wily, restless, deceitful schemer.
A real manipulator.
Yeah. This is a person whose waking mind is always playing 3-dimensional chess. They're constantly manipulating facts, sliding sideways from one association to the next, never really allowing their mind to rest squarely on the simple truth.
Right.
And as they sleep, their dream mimics that exact same architecture. It's like a frantic hall of
Oh,
mirrors.
that's a great way to put it.
They dream they're looking at a clock on the wall, but then the clock melts into a human face. The face opens its mouth, and a train drives out. And as the train rushes forward, it shatters into a massive flock of birds.
Just endless chaotic sliding.
Exactly. An endless cascade of associations. So by the time the morning sun comes up, they're left with this tangled knot of imagery that no one alive could possibly follow back to its origin.
Because there might be fragmented pieces of genuine memory in that storm, you know,
Yeah.
but they've been shredded and glued back together in such an utterly chaotic way.
Yeah.
The dream itself contains no legible meaning. It's just the frantic spinning of an untethered, persistently anxious mind doing exactly what it's trained itself to do.
Which brings us to the third house.
Right.
In this bed sleeps a remarkably plain, honest, and truthful person. Someone whose waking mind does not embroider the truth, you know. They don't exaggerate to make a story sound better, and they don't deceive others or themselves.
It's a clear-eyed person.
Exactly. And in her dream, she sees a very mundane, intensely literal event. She sees her sister walking through her front door on a rainy afternoon, holding a specific blue teacup with a small, distinct chip on the rim.
Very specific.
Very specific, crisp, clear, perfectly mundane. And next week, on a Tuesday afternoon, that exact event is going to happen, down to the rain and the chip on the teacup.
Wow.
Her dream was a clear window. She won't even be particularly surprised when it happens because she already saw it plainly, exactly as the event unfolds in reality.
Right, it involves zero distortion. It's a direct, unobstructed reception of a future fact.
Which leaves us with the fourth house. In this room, the sleeper sees a massive dark serpent coiled tightly in the corner of their bedroom, staring unblinkingly at them.
Oof. Nightmarish.
Yeah. When this person wakes up, their heart is pounding, the fear is very real, yet they possess this incredibly strange, unshakable certainty that the snake wasn't actually a reptile.
Right. They know it's a symbol.
Exactly. They know deeply in their bones that the serpent stood for something else entirely. It was a genuine message that had been dressed up in a heavy costume, and it desperately needs to be translated before they can understand what it actually means.
So we have 4 sleepers, 4 distinct physiological and psychological experiences, all filed away under a single honestly very inadequate English word.
Dream.
Exactly, dream.
And the author we are deep diving into today claims that out of those four people, only one of them actually requires a dream interpreter.
Right.
If we can figure out which one, and much more importantly, the underlying mechanics of why, it's going to hand us the master key to cracking the most staggering mysteries in human history.
Which is quite the claim.
It is. We're talking about the mechanics of prophecy. We're talking about miracles. We're talking about sorcerers operating in the dark.
Yeah. It sounds almost impossibly bold, like an impossibly bold promise. Yet the brilliance of the philosophical framework we're exploring today is that cracking the code of those four bedrooms genuinely does provide the skeleton key.
Yeah.
The core argument here is that the exact same machinery operating faintly in the minds of those sleeping people is the identical machinery that, when scaled up and utilized consciously while awake, allows a human being to bend reality.
Which is just mind-blowing. But we should ground ourselves before we go any further.
Good idea.
We are in the finale part two of our two-part series, diving into a text called On Dreams and Prophecies. It was authored by the great philosopher Elama Tabatabaik. That's pronounced A-L-A-E.
Yes, the legendary Alame.
So for anyone who might need a brief refresher on where we left off, or, you know, for those jumping in right now, we can summarize the entire foundation we built in part one in basically three strict sentences.
Let's hear them.
First, human beings are the universe's great unfinished animals. Our soul builds its own shape out of its repeated daily acts, and it uses our attention as the master lever to construct that shape.
Perfect.
Second, in our normal waking state, the soul is deafened and crowded by the physical senses, but it has the capacity to unify itself, quiet that sensory crowd down, and return to its own higher world to perceive reality directly, entirely without the use of the physical body.
Right, getting off the sensory floor.
Exactly. And third, underneath every single frantic human desire, whether it is a reach for money, for love, or for power, there is actually just one single unified reach toward one absolute real good.
That's a perfect summary. Those three principles are really the engine of everything we're talking about today.
Yeah.
We spent the entirety of part one essentially in the garage, right? Building and wiring this machine, tightening the bolts on the theory of the human soul.
And today we are throwing the switch. We are plugging that machine into the wall and turning it on at full power to see what it can actually do when it reaches its absolute limits.
Yeah.
And to initiate that test, Alama starts us off in the most democratic, universally understood place imaginable, which is asleep in the dark.
Right. Because everyone sleeps. Everyone dreams.
Exactly. The science of dreams, as Alama lays it out, is the gateway. He challenges skeptics directly by pointing to the sheer volume of historical evidence. I mean, in every culture, in every era of recorded human history, there are reports of dreams that, to use his translation, tell plainly of the hidden recesses of things and of events to come.
You just can't responsibly wave away the entire historical record of human experience.
You can't. The question we need to answer is not whether this phenomenon happens. The vastly more demanding question is what the actual mechanics are when it does happen.
And those mechanics flow seamlessly from the machine we just described. I mean, consider your waking life. Your soul is essentially playing air traffic controller for a deeply demanding physical body.
A very demanding body.
Right. It has to constantly monitor and manage your breathing, your digestion, the ambient temperature of the room, the sound of the traffic outside your window, the anxiety of an incoming email.
It's exhausting.
The soul's attention is entirely bogged down, completely captivated by the heavy physical world.
It is pinned to the sensory floor of existence.
But the moment you fall asleep, that sensory noise gets dialed down to a whisper. The body's relentless grip on your attention loosens dramatically.
Yes.
And Alame uses this really beautiful phrase to describe this moment. He says, "The field on the whole lies open to her." Her referring to the soul.
I love that phrasing.
Sleep is, mechanically speaking, a nightly, temporary, partial return of the soul to its own home turf.
It returns specifically to what the tradition calls the world of image, or mythal, pronounced mythal. We touched on the architecture of reality briefly before, but we really must emphasize it here.
Let's do that.
Mythal is a floor of reality that sits structurally just above our physical material world. It's a realm containing forms, meanings, and realities that simply do not possess heavy physical bodies. So when the human soul slips the leash of the sleeping body, it naturally drifts upward and brushes up against these realities.
So it goes wandering and actually touches something real. That part makes sense to me. But the soul doesn't just wake up and hand your conscious mind a neatly typed memo with the objective facts it discovered, right?
No, not at all.
It has to pass that raw information through a translator. And according to Alima, that internal translator is your imagination.
And this requires a major, major pivot in how modern people define imagination.
Yeah, we usually mean making stuff up.
Exactly. We typically use that word to describe the faculty of making things up, fiction, fantasy, daydreaming. But in this specific philosophical architecture, the imagination is not a fiction generator. It is a rendering engine. It is a highly localized translation device.
The analogy that really helps me grasp this is picturing the imagination as a frantic art director at a local, severely underfunded theater.
Huh. Yes, that's perfect.
Imagine the soul comes rushing into the theater from the higher realms, holding this incredibly profound, entirely abstract truth it just discovered. It hands this abstract script to the art director and demands, stage this play immediately.
Right.
But the art director, your imagination, has absolutely no budget to build new sets. They only have access to the random props that happen to be lying around in the dusty backstage of your specific mind.
Yeah.
Your personal memories, your daily habits, your intense fears, the cultural symbols you absorbed growing up.
The imagination is literally incapable of presenting a purely abstract spiritual reality to your conscious mind. It simply lacks the vocabulary.
Right.
So it frantically grabs whatever existing images it has access to and forces the abstract truth to wear those specific clothes.
And that single mechanism, a soul that touches an abstract truth, combined with an imagination that desperately tries to paint a picture of it, that creates the four bins of dreams, it perfectly explains our four sleepers from the cold open.
It really does. Alima categorizes all human dreams strictly using this exact architecture.
Okay, so let's walk through the bins.
So the first bin is the sleeper we saw in the first house, the symptom dream. Here, the soul is not touching high truths at all. The physical body is screaming so loudly in distress that the imagination has to paint it to give it form.
So a rising fever becomes a dream of a raging fire.
Right. Or a cold draft blowing across the bed becomes a dream of being trapped in a snowstorm. Alima is delightfully blunt in his assessment of this category. He states categorically that these dreams have absolutely no meaning. There is no profound translation taking place. It is merely the visualization of bodily noise.
I find that incredibly relieving, honestly. Sometimes a nightmare really is just a late night pizza, not some cosmic warning of impending doom.
Definitely just the pizza sometimes.
But let's look at bin number two, our restless, deceitful schemer in the second house.
Ah, yes. This is the muddled dream. The Arabic term Alima uses here is crucial. Agath Alim. Pronounced adjuashayates ala kalama. It translates roughly to jumbled bundles.
Jumbled bundles. I like that.
In this scenario, the imagination is totally untethered and unmanaged. Instead of translating one specific truth into one specific symbol, it goes completely haywire. It chains one image to the next and then to the next in an endless, meaningless, associative loop.
It's the art director just throwing every prop they own onto the stage simultaneously without a script just to see what happens.
Exactly. And furthermore, Alima drops a really profound psychological insight here. He notes that this kind of chaotic, muddled dreaming befalls mostly, quote, the wily, deceitful man.
That line stopped me in my tracks,
right,
because it makes devastating sense. If you spend your waking life manipulating facts, constantly sliding away from the truth, building elaborate halls of mirrors to deceive the people around you, why on earth would your sleeping mind behave any differently?
It wouldn't.
You have actively trained your imagination to be chaotic, slippery, and evasive.
It perfectly reinforces the central thesis of part one. The soul builds its enduring shape through repetition. If you practice deceit and endless association all day long, your soul adopts that exact shape. Your nights will inevitably have the exact same character as your days.
Whoa.
And there is no dream interpretation available for a muddled dream because the knot is so intricately tangled it can never be unraveled.
Which carries us to bin number three, the clear window. Our third sleeper, who dreamed of the chipped teacup. Alima calls this the true untampered dream. In Arabic, this pure reception is called ruya, pronounced R-O-Y-A.
In the ruya, the soul touches a genuine reality in the higher world, and for whatever reason, the imagination completely abstains from interfering.
The art director takes the night off.
The art director is asleep at the wheel. The soul simply hands the image over to the conscious mind exactly as it exists. It requires no interpretation because no translation was ever attempted.
And Alama pairs this with another striking psychological truth. He argues that this kind of perfectly clear, untampered dreaming falls mostly to one whose mind is free of tampering. He explicitly writes that truthfulness brings true dreams.
Yes.
If you are a plain, honest person who insists on looking at reality squarely and plainly while you are awake, your soul retains that identical posture when you are asleep. It refuses to distort. It refuses to dress things up in costumes.
It functions as a stunning rebuke to the modern assumption that our sleep is some isolated, disconnected realm separate from our moral waking life. Alama is arguing that your moral clarity dictates your perceptual clarity, even in total darkness.
That brings us to the fourth and final bin, the only dream out of the four that actually demands an interpreter, the figured dream. Our sleeper who woke up terrified of the serpent.
This is where the profound discipline of interpretation, or Dabir, pronounced Pa-Bir, comes into play.
Right.
In the figured dream, the soul touches a genuine abstract reality, but the imagination actively steps in to do its job. It takes that abstract reality and dresses it up in a localized symbol. It might translate the abstract concept of height into a soaring minaret. It might translate glory into a golden crown. Or it translates an approaching enemy into a coiled serpent.
So the job of the dream interpreter is essentially reverse engineering the art director's choices.
The word tabir literally implies crossing over. The interpreter must take the presented symbol, hold it up to the light, and painstakingly walk backwards along the associative chain until they successfully locate the original abstract truth the soul actually bumped into in the missal.
Okay. I need to push back heavily on how this works in practice, though.
Go for it.
We live in a culture absolutely saturated with these dream dictionaries. You see them constantly in books or websites that promise a universal cipher. If you dream of your teeth falling out, it means you have anxiety about aging. If you dream of a snake, it universally means betrayal. Does this philosophical framework support that kind of universal indexing? Because to me, it feels incredibly reductive and, well, mechanical.
Your instinct to push back is entirely justified. While some might argue that certain symbols are universal because human biology is universal-like, we all have a nervous system that fears fangs or falling. Alama's framework insists that the imagination is a profoundly localized, personal rendering engine. He firmly and structurally debunks the concept of a universal dream dictionary.
Because if the imagination is pulling from the backstage of my mind, it doesn't matter what a snake means to humanity at large. It matters what a snake means to me.
Exactly. To assume a universal dictionary is to assume everyone's imagination utilizes the identical filing system. A snake in a dream cannot mean betrayal for everyone. If the dreamer happens to be a severe phobic who is terrified of reptiles, the snake might indeed symbolize a creeping enemy or a deep, paralyzing fear.
Yeah.
But what if the dreamer is a passionate, dedicated herpetologist who studies snakes for a living?
Oh, that changes everything.
Right. For them, a snake might symbolize a highly successful day at work, or the thrill of scientific discovery, or a state of deep focus.
So the interpreter is essentially flying blind if they just look at the symbol. They have to perform a comprehensive psychological audit of the dreamer before they can even begin to translate.
They absolutely must. Alma insists that to run the translation in reverse, the interpreter must intimately know the dreamer's daily habits, their specific trade, their persistent worries, their character, their cultural background, even their physical temperament. The symbol is intensely personal. The cipher is keyed entirely to the unique individual shape of that specific human soul.
We have just taken one of the most profound ancient mysteries of human experience, the prophetic or deeply meaningful dream, and reduced it to a completely coherent, understandable mechanism. A soul slips its physical leash, touches the real, and a personal imagination paints a picture of what it touched.
It strips away the spooky, arbitrary magic from the equation and replaces it with an internally consistent, rigorous mechanics of consciousness.
But solving that mystery immediately raises a massive secondary question.
Natural.
Because everything we just described in the dreaming process is passive. The soul goes wandering, it receives information, it looks at things. But if a soul off its leash can passively receive information from beyond its physical skin, is it possible for that identical soul to reach out and actively alter reality beyond its skin? Can it touch the world back?
That is the precise transition Alama makes as we move into Act Two.
Hmm.
We pivot from passive reception to active power. We move from the dreamer in their bed to the miracle worker standing in the waking world.
Before we dissect the mechanics of how someone alters reality, I have to ask a deeply practical question.
Okay.
If this active power exists, if human souls can theoretically reach out and heal a sickness from a distance or move objects, why isn't there a manual for it? Why isn't there a textbook mapping out exactly how to achieve this? Why is it relegated to spooky folklore, scattered rumors, and vague traditions?
Alameh addresses this with a confession that is quietly profound. He admits openly that humanity has inherited almost no real systematized science on this subject. We merely possess scattered reports throughout history. Persistent tales of the evil eye, of miraculous healings at a distance, of rare individuals with such intense, focused resolve, what the tradition calls hima, pronounced hima, that they can literally bend physical events to their will.
So why didn't the great philosophers or mystics sit down and map it out so we could understand it?
Because, Alameh explains, the incredibly rare, highly unified souls who are actually capable of mapping this power, the ones who have successfully reached that level of internal ascension, they are universally busy with higher things. When your consciousness reaches that level of spiritual elevation, the ability to move a physical object across a table or cure a physical ailment from afar suddenly seems incredibly trivial compared to the overwhelming contemplation of the absolute real.
Right, it's just not important anymore.
Exactly. They don't bother writing a manual for what are essentially physical parlor tricks because their gaze is fixed on the divine. And as for ordinary people, if a flicker of this power ever accidentally passes through them, they usually let it slip, ignore it, and immediately get distracted by the trivialities of their daily lives.
So the only people who understand how to operate the toys are the people who have fundamentally outgrown the desire to play with toys.
Precisely. So what Alameh offers instead of a step-by-step manual is the foundational principle. He maps the structural architecture of reality that makes this kind of action at a distance possible at all. And to understand it, we must visualize the stacked floors of existence.
Let's lay out the building. Paint the picture of this metaphysics for us.
Okay, imagine reality itself as a towering skyscraper with distinct, rigidly ranked floors. At the very penthouse, the absolute top floor, is the first real, the absolute God.
Yeah.
Below that exists the world of pure intellects, entirely immaterial beings devoid of shape. Below that is the world of image, the mythal we just discussed, where forms and meanings exist without heavy physical matter. And at the very bottom on the dense ground floor is our world, the physical material world of bodies, time, and space.
Penthouse down to the lobby. We are in the lobby.
Yes. Now, here is the crucial load-bearing rule that governs this entire system. Causation runs exclusively downward.
Okay, break down what downward causation actually means in practice.
It means that the order of things, the laws of nature, and the events that manifest down here in the physical world are actually caused and sustained by realities existing on the floor directly above us. The physical world is merely the output floor. The control room dictating that output is one floor up.
It's like looking at a computer monitor.
Yes, exactly.
The physical world is the glass screen. We see a character move on the screen or a document print out of a printer. But the actual cause of that movement isn't happening on the glass itself. It's happening inside the CPU. It's happening in the source code. Hmm. If you want to permanently change what prints out on the paper, you don't draw on the paper with a marker. You go into the software. You go upstairs to the control room.
That is a flawless modern translation of Alameh's point. Every physical event is the downstream printout of a higher reality. So connect this fundamental law of physics back to the human soul we built in part one.
Right, the unfinished animal.
Exactly. We established that the human soul, unlike a rock or a tree, is uniquely capable of climbing. Through intense purification, through the grueling mastery of attention and focus, it can detach its awareness from the physical lobby and ascend the stairs to the higher floors.
It quiets the sensory crowd and ascends to the world of image.
And as it achieves that altitude, Alameh says, it gains a kind of localized union with that higher rank. It stops being merely a passive recipient of whatever events are flowing down from the top, and it starts to become, in a highly localized way, an origin, a source.
If you can manage to get your consciousness upstairs into the server room of reality, you have essentially gained access to the levers of physical causation.
Yes. You have achieved what Alameh calls the ascendancy over the inward of things. You are standing upstream of the physical world. And from that elevated vantage point, a unified soul can produce effects down here on the ground floor that look, to everyone trapped in the lobby, utterly impossible.
We're talking about saintly healing. We're talking about the evil eye,
mm-hmm.
or moving things with Hema, that intense, focused resolve.
It explains all of it. Mm-hmm. And the most vital thing to understand is that these individuals are not breaking the laws of nature. That is a fundamental, widespread misunderstanding of what a miracle actually is in this framework.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they aren't breaking the rules. They are simply operating the machinery from a floor above the one we can see. They have earned administrator privileges.
Because they subjected themselves to the discipline required to climb the stairs.
Now, Alameh plants a seed here that is going to become the climactic revelation of our entire discussion. He points out that this downward flow of reality possesses two distinct faces. The good inherent in this downward order traces back to what the tradition calls the angel, the existent that serves as the principle of good.
Oh.
And the evil in it traces back to what the tradition calls the Satan, the existent that serves as the principle of evil.
A light source and a dark source, both operating in that upper architecture.
Keep that image firmly planted in your mind. Because the ultimate shocking claim of this treatise is that the stairs going up to the control room are themselves neutral. The identical staircase can be climbed by a soul facing the angel or by a soul actively facing the Satan. But before we dare to look at the dark side of that ascent, we must first look at the figure who climbs it all the way to the absolute top, facing the light.
The prophet.
Which brings us to the exploration of why, structurally and logically, there must be prophets.
What I found so deeply compelling about this section is that Alameh refuses to simply assert this as a matter of blind faith. He doesn't say, well, God decided to send prophets, so you just have to accept it. He builds a strictly logical, architectural argument for the absolute necessity of prophets.
Mm-hmm.
We are witnessing the tradition reasoning about itself, utilizing the precise mechanics of consciousness we've already established.
It is a masterful piece of deductive reasoning. Let's walk through the logic step by step.
Let's do it.
Step one relies directly on the floors of reality we just discussed. The highest possible perfection of any human soul is to climb those stairs, reach the control room, and perceive the reality of the absolute real directly. But practically speaking, only the rarest, most equable, perfectly balanced souls can actually survive that climb on their own.
Yeah.
The vast, overwhelming majority of humanity is simply too entangled in survival, too burdened by physical needs, or too distracted by the senses to get upstairs unassisted.
The staircase exists, the destination is undeniably real, but 99.9% of us are permanently stuck in the lobby trying to find our car keys.
Exactly. Step two. Alameh establishes that the first real, the source of all existence, possesses complete and absolute care for its creation. The Arabic term utilized here is inaya, pronounced E-N-A-A-Y-A. It means solicitude, profound and encompassing care. As Alameh beautifully writes, his tenderness is without end.
The universe is fundamentally governed by a profound structural care for the beings that inhabit it.
And here's the logical crux of the entire argument. A care that is genuinely complete cannot possibly leave a potential human perfection unrealized.
Oh, I see.
Right. If it is structurally possible for human beings to reach this ultimate flourishing, then a perfectly caring universe cannot just shrug and say, well, most of them won't figure it out. What a shame. Guidance must arrive. It would represent a catastrophic logical contradiction, a gaping hole in the universe's anaya, if a pathway wasn't actively provided for the billions of people stuck in the lobby.
If the universe cares, it has to throw a rope down. But why does that rope have to take the form of a human prophet? Why doesn't this profound care just magically beam the correct knowledge directly into everyone's head simultaneously? Or why not just physically levitate everyone up the stairs against their will?
That leads directly to step three. Guidance cannot be a cosmic override. It cannot be forced upon us. Why? Because of the very fundamental nature of what a human being actually is.
The unfinished animal.
Yes. Going all the way back to part one, a human soul builds its shape solely through its own free choices and repeated daily acts. If you force a soul to do something, if you compel it mechanically, you entirely bypass its agency, and therefore you defeat the entire purpose of its self-creation.
If an outside force compels me to act perfectly, I haven't actually become good. I'm just a well-programmed puppet.
Thus, the guidance must be offered in a way that profoundly respects human freedom. It has to persuade. It must offer, in Alameh's specific phrasing, true urging, true promise, true threat. It has to be something a human being can look at, evaluate with their intellect, and freely choose to either follow or reject.
Let's synthesize the constraints of these three steps. Most people cannot get to the control room. The universe's complete care mathematically demands that they receive guidance. But that guidance cannot be beamed into their heads by brute force. It must be delivered in a human, comprehensible, actionable way.
When you lock those constraints together, Alamy argues, there is only one logical solution remaining on the board.
Which is?
The guidance must land on those exceedingly rare, exceptional souls who actually can make the grueling climb of the control room. They receive the reality upstairs, and then they carry it back down the stairs in a translated, accessible form that the rest of the people in the lobby can actually utilize to build their souls.
I kept picturing a deep sea diver.
Oh, I like that.
The vast majority of humanity is stranded at the bottom of the ocean floor, and we simply do not have the lung capacity to swim all the way to the surface to get oxygen. If the universe possesses a Naya, it has to get oxygen down to us. But it cannot just forcefully inflate our lungs against our will.
Right.
So the structural solution is the diver. One individual who does possess the immense strength and the specialized biological capacity to swim all the way up, break the surface, take a massive breath of pure reality, and then swim all the way back down, carrying a pressurized oxygen tank for the rest of us to freely breathe from if we choose to.
That analogy perfectly encapsulates the structural necessity. The prophet is not just a random person who won a cosmic lottery and got handed a magic wand. They are the structural answer to a profound metaphysical problem.
Wow.
The tradition provides precise definitions to separate these roles. A soul who climbs up and receives this reality purely for himself is called a Nabi, pronounced Nabi, a prophet. But a soul who receives it and is explicitly structurally charged to carry the oxygen tank back down to the others is called a Rasul, pronounced Rasul, a messenger.
When the messenger successfully arrives back down in the lobby, what exactly is inside the oxygen tank? What is the tangible package they are delivering to the rest of us?
That package is the Sharia, pronounced Sha-R-E-A. Alma insists it must contain four highly specific components. What is so elegant here is that these four components correspond flawlessly to the necessary requirements of the self-building soul we defined in part one.
Walk me through the four components.
The first component is knowing. This is the metaphysical map of reality. It outlines the truth about existence, about who the first real is, the divine names and attributes, how the cosmos originated, and where it ultimately returns. It grounds the human soul in absolute reality.
Okay, that makes sense.
The second component is becoming. This constitutes the realm of ethics. It strictly delineates the virtues and vices, teaching the soul which internal shapes lead to flourishing and which internal shapes are fundamentally toxic.
We are unfinished animals, so we desperately need the blueprints to know how to finish ourselves safely. What is the third?
Living together. These are the social laws, the rules governing the household, commerce, and the community. As we established, you cannot build a soul in a vacuum. We forge our internal shapes while constantly bumping into each other in a crowded, high-friction world. The social laws exist to prevent us from casually destroying each other's spiritual progress.
And the fourth component, this is the one that completely reframed my understanding, worship. But Alamy explains worship in a way that feels incredibly practical, almost mechanical, rather than purely devotional.
He fundamentally redefines it. For Alamy, worship is not just arbitrary praise meant to flatter a needy deity. Worship is scheduled maintenance.
I want to spend a moment on this because it is so vital. If I've spent years building a unified, focused soul, why do I need a repetitive ritual? Shouldn't the structure just hold on its own?
Because you are constantly submerged in the sensory world. The lobby is incredibly loud. Remember the core rule of soul building. A character trait is forged by repeated acts. But it's also dissolved by contrary acts.
Right.
If you spend years building a soul that is generous and focused on the real, but then you step out into a chaotic, greedy, hyper-competitive world, the daily friction of that environment is going to slowly erode your hard-won shape. Every time you give in to a petty anger in traffic, you are reinforcing a lower-level shape.
Wow.
Worship, the daily prayers, the fasting, the repeated physical rituals acts as the anchor. It is the necessary scheduled maintenance that stops the soul's new shape from washing away in the relentless tide of physical life.
It's going to the gym to maintain the muscle you spent years building. If you stop the maintenance, the muscle inevitably atrophies.
Because this package, this Sharia, is delivered to human beings living inside the flow of human history, Alamy notes two inevitable consequences. First, because human society actively evolves, expands, and matures across the ages, the message must occasionally be updated. The curriculum is naturally revised as a student grows in capacity. The later messages complete and refine the earlier ones.
It's the necessary progression from middle school math to high school calculus.
Exactly. The second consequence is far more sobering. Because human beings are notoriously prone to drifting, distorting facts, and forgetting the truth over generations, this message cannot merely be dropped off and left to its own devices. It requires a permanent guardian.
Someone to ensure the oxygen tank doesn't get contaminated by the people in the lobby.
Precisely. In every single age, there must be someone whose link to that upper world never fractures. A soul that is divinely protected from error, what the tradition calls namasum, pronounced masum. This enduring figure is the imam, pronounced I am. The imam's role is not necessarily to bring a new message, but to ferociously guard the existing truth, to act by it with perfect clarity, and to call others to act by it. Alama emphasizes that prophethood, the bringing of new messages, can eventually cease, but guardianship never does. The world is never, in any era, left entirely devoid of that protected link.
It is important to explicitly note for you listening that this specific architecture of the enduring divinely protected guide is openly the Shia philosophical vision. What is so deeply fascinating is watching Alama build this not simply by quoting scriptural authority, but by demonstrating how it flows logically and necessarily out of the fundamental physics of the human soul.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
A staircase only a few can climb, a profound cosmic care that must act, a truth painstakingly carried down, and a truth that must be fiercely guarded.
It is a meticulously reasoned account from the inside of the tradition reasoning about itself. But as watertight as this logic might appear in the quiet of a philosophy classroom, it runs headfirst into a brutal, practical problem the very moment our messenger steps out into the noisy real world.
If I'm standing in the lobby and some guy walks down the stairs holding an oxygen tank and announces, hey, I just came from the control room of the universe and you need to radically alter your life and follow these rules, how on earth am I supposed to know if he is actually telling the truth?
You can't just take his word for it.
I can't check his credentials. I've never been upstairs. He could be a perfectly confident, charismatic fraud, or he could be suffering from a profound hallucination. Bare reason alone isn't going to silence the immense public doubt.
Alma acknowledges this fully and practically. Most people simply lack the capacity to follow a dense, multi-tiered philosophical proof of prophethood. Furthermore, even for the intellectuals who can follow the logic perfectly, Alame acutely observes that the human mind rarely rests completely quiet. It is endlessly needled by hidden, subtly derived objections. Even the sharpest, most devout thinker has nagging doubts whispering in the dark.
So a structural argument isn't enough to secure belief. There must be a public sign.
That sign is the miracle. The mujiza, pronounced mu-yo-jiza.
But again, relying on this framework, the miracle isn't just a flashy magic trick meant to dazzle the uneducated peasants. It serves a precise, mechanically necessary function.
It serves as the ultimate verification protocol. We established earlier that a soul that has genuinely reached the upper floors gains tangible access to the control room of physical reality. They can exert downward causation. The miracle is simply that exact capacity manifested publicly at the precise moment of challenge.
The moment of challenge. There's a specific term for that, right?
Yes. Tahadi, pronounced Tahadi. The profound moment where the skeptical public essentially says, prove it.
Show me the proof.
Exactly. The true messenger, suckles from the higher world, can reach upstream into the causes of things and produce an effect down here on the ground floor that is utterly impossible for ordinary physical nature to counterfeit. Turning a wooden staff into a living serpent, healing a blind man with a mere touch. And Alamen notes that because they are backed by the limitless power of the first reel, the true messenger is never overcome in this public contest.
It visibly proves they actually possess administrator privileges. They aren't just guessing. They demonstrably hold the keys to the server room.
While we're exploring how these prophets receive their connection to the upstairs, Alamen makes a very careful, subtle distinction between the varying modes of contact they experience.
He distinguishes between revelation and inspiration. Let's unpack the difference.
When a prophet receives knowledge from the higher world, sometimes they actually witness the specific cause of that knowledge. They might visibly see the angelic presence delivering the message. The channel of communication is entirely visible and identifiable to them. That specific, fully witnessed experience is what Alamet properly defines as way, pronounced way h-i, revelation.
Revelation comes with a clear return address. The prophet knows exactly who is handing them the envelope.
There is another mode. Sometimes, profound, undeniable knowledge simply appears in the soul. The person suddenly knows something with absolute blazing certainty, but there is no visible angel. There is no seen cause. The truth is just suddenly overwhelmingly present.
It arrives anonymously.
Yes. That mode is called ilham, pronounced ilham. inspiration. Alima also notes that this category includes those eerie, deeply unsettling experiences found in many global traditions of the Hatif, pronounced H-A-T-I-F, the unseen caller, a voice that is heard clearly, delivering a coherent message, but with absolutely no speaker visible to the eye.
We have spent a long time building this incredible, majestic picture. The purified soul climbs the grueling stairs of reality, reaches the control room, communes with the angel, brings back the Sharia to heal humanity, and proves their absolute authority by manifesting undeniable miracles. It is a beautiful, light-filled, awe-inspiring architecture.
But this brings us to the twist. The dark twin of everything we have just spent the last hour discussing.
This is where the treatise gets genuinely chilling. Alima introduces a reality that completely upends our normal, comfortable assumptions about the nature of spiritual power. He states that everything we just described, the grueling climb up the stairs, the absolute mastery of the physical senses, the ability to get upstream of reality and bend the physical world, the ability to see hidden things and predict future events. A human being can achieve all of it on the road of evil.
It is undeniably the most shocking revelation in the entire text. The sorcerer climbs the exact same staircase as the prophet.
I really want to emphasize this because it shattered my preconceptions. We naturally tend to think of magic or dark arts as some entirely separate illicit cheat code, a different magic system entirely. But Alima says, no, there's only one human machine. There's only one architecture of reality.
That's right.
The sorcerer utilizes the exact same disciplines. Intense focus, brutal isolation, extreme purification of their specific intent to unify their soul and successfully slip the leash of the body. They, too, gain the altitude necessary to reach the world of image.
From that elevated vantage point, they work, sir, pronounced S-I-H-R, magic. Because they have successfully reached the control room, they possess the capacity to deeply tamper with the downward flow of reality.
Which is terrifying.
It is. They can actively bewitch people's perception, making them see terrifying things that aren't there. They can produce real catastrophic outward physical effects. Mm-hmm. They can sicken a healthy body from miles away or even heal it if it serves their purpose. They can bind people together in unnatural obsessive love or tear families apart in sudden hatred.
It is the exact same downward mechanic as the miracle, just weaponized for harm.
Completely. Their access to the hidden realms flawlessly mirrors the prophet's access. By elevating their souls, they can become a kahin, pronounced ka'ahen, a soothsayer. The dark practice of kihana, pronounced kihahana, allows them to glimpse the intimate secrets hidden in people's breasts or snatch fragmented glimpses of future events before they unfold.
They can even subjugate other entities to do their bidding, right?
Through the intense practice of taskir, pronounced taskir, they can force their unified soul to dominate lesser immaterial beings, such as the jinn, pronounced G-I-N-N. They can press these unseen spirits into brutal service, forcing them to fetch distant information or carry out physical tasks.
I am struggling with the neutrality of this. If I am a bystander on the ground floor and I see someone pointing their finger and moving a mountain, or flawlessly telling me my deepest, darkest secrets, how do I possibly know if I'm looking at a holy prophet or a monstrous sorcerer?
It's the ultimate question.
If they are running the identical equipment and they possess the identical spiritual horsepower, what is the actual difference? Why doesn't the universe just install a firewall that blocks you the moment you turn toward the dark?
That touches on the absolute terror of human freedom. If the universe installed a firewall that blocked you the moment you turned toward the Satan, then your choice to face the angel wouldn't be a genuine choice. It would be a mechanical constraint. The system must remain utterly neutral, so that the moral weight of the climb remains entirely on the climber.
That makes a lot of sense.
As to your question of how to tell the difference, this is the climax of the entire treatise. Alima's answer is delivered in a single, blade-clean sentence. It serves as the thesis for the entire back half of the book. I'm going to read it exactly as he wrote it because it carries immense weight.
Please do.
The criterion in all of this is the inclining toward the false and the joining with it.
The inclining toward the false and the joining with it.
That is the entire terrifying difference. It is not about the sheer amount of power displayed. A sorcerer might be formidably, terrifyingly powerful, capable of leveling cities. It is not about the technique utilized. The meditative techniques and brutal disciplines often overlap entirely. The difference is exclusively, fundamentally, about direction.
Which way you are facing on the stairs?
Remember the two opposing principles we discussed earlier. The angel, the enduring principle of good and reality. And the Satan, the principle of evil and falsehood. The prophet climbs the grueling stairs, in a state of total self-emptying surrender, facing entirely toward the absolute real. They want nothing but to serve the light.
And the sorcerer?
The sorcerer climbs the exact same stairs, with immense terrifying discipline, but their soul is curled violently inward. They are actively facing the dark. They are climbing solely to serve their own ravenous appetites, their own inflated ego, their own insatiable desire for domination over others.
The miracle and the dark spell are, mechanically speaking, the exact same reach into the exact same control room.
What makes one holy and the other monstrous is the fundamental truth we established back in the very beginning of part one, the moral orientation of the soul. What has the soul consistently said yes to? The most sobering, challenging implication of this entire two-part journey lands right here. Spiritual power is not a synonym for goodness.
Let that sit. Spiritual power is not the same thing as goodness.
Power is simply a measure of altitude. It is just a marker of how high up the staircase you have managed to climb. Goodness is determined entirely by the direction you are facing while you climb it.
I want us to step back for a moment and just admire the sheer elegance of what this author has actually achieved here. We are looking at a genuinely unified theory of human experience.
It is breathtakingly economical in its design. Think about the five distinct phenomena we have thoroughly covered.
Okay.
The mundane dream that miraculously comes true in the night. The ascetic saint who heals a sickness from 1,000 miles away. The prophet receiving a world-altering revelation. The public miracle that seemingly shatters the laws of physics. And the sorcerer weaving a dark, destructive spell.
If you ask almost any culture on Earth, they will confidently file those under five entirely different folders of mystery, coincidence, or magic.
Yet Alameh has gathered all five and rigorously demonstrated that they are not five different mysteries at all. They are one single cohesive phenomenon. They were all simply variations of the human soul. The unfinished animal we built in part one, slipping the heavy leash of the physical body and reaching into the higher floors of reality.
The ordinary dreamer does it accidentally, faintly, for a few confused minutes every night. The prophet does it powerfully, while wide awake entirely on purpose, facing the light. And the sorcerer does it powerfully on purpose, facing the dark. One ladder, different rungs, different directions.
The detail that truly reveals the staggering caliber of the mind that constructed this architecture arrives at the very end of the treatise. Alameh makes a profound admission. He openly acknowledges that the Islamic tradition he belongs to is absolutely overflowing with textual reports about every single one of these topics. There are thousands of hadith, thousands of scriptural traditions debating dreams, miracles, the jinn, and prophecy.
A literal mountain of religious evidence and quotes he could have leaned on to prove his point.
But he explicitly tells the reader that he deliberately chose to leave almost all of it out of this book. He set himself an audacious, staggering constraint. He writes that he chose to argue this entire towering edifice, quote, on the way of bare reason alone. The Arabic phrase he uses is, ala sabil al-aqla musharad.
On the way of bare reason alone. Why would a deeply religious scholar tie his own hands like that? Why ignore the holy texts of his own tradition when discussing the foundational necessity of prophets?
Because he wanted to relentlessly prove to the reader that this architecture stands entirely on its own inherent philosophical logic. He refused to simply say miracles happen because the holy book dictates that they do. He wanted to derive the absolute necessity of the miracle and the precise mechanics of the dream purely from a foundational theory of human consciousness. He built the entire theology from the ground up, starting with nothing but the physics of the human soul.
It makes me think of a physicist trying to prove the existence of the ocean. Instead of just taking you to the beach, pointing at the vast water and saying, look, there it is, just believe your eyes. They lock themselves in a windowless laboratory with a single microscopic drop of water.
That's a great way to think about it.
And by perfectly mathematically analyzing the internal atomic structure of that single drop, they conclusively prove that an entire ocean must exist. Alameh took the single drop of the human soul, analyzed its inherent capacity for attention and upward ascent, and mathematically proved the structural necessity of prophets and the existence of the control room of reality.
It functions as an act of immense intellectual humility, but simultaneously an act of staggering intellectual confidence. He is essentially saying to the reader, here is the raw, unadorned reasoning. You do not have to share my specific faith to follow the math. Check the architecture yourself.
We have to provide the historical context of when this was written because the visual image is just stunning.
In his closing note, Alameh meticulously records the exact moment he finished writing this treatise. It was the morning of a Saturday, the 11th of Jumada the 2nd, 1350 in the Islamic calendar.
Which translates to an October dawn in the year 1931.
in the ancient city of Najaf. He was a deeply impoverished young scholar, not even 30 years old at the time. Picture him sitting in the profound quiet of the early morning, the sun just barely coming up over the horizon, closing his notebook. He has just spent the night painstakingly mapping the absolute far limits of human consciousness, seamlessly unifying the mundane dream of the chipped teacup with the divine revelation that found civilizations purely on the unyielding strength of bare reason.
A 29-year-old quietly cracking the code of the universe before breakfast. It is a genuinely awe-inspiring image to hold, which perfectly brings us to the gathering of our journey. We need to tie both of these episodes together. We have covered a massive expanse of conceptual ground across part one and part two of this deep dive.
We really have. In part one, we constructed the machine. We established the human being as the great unfinished animal. We observed how the soul aggressively assembles its very self out of its repeated, seemingly trivial daily acts. We identified attention as the master lever that moves the soul, and we discovered that beneath every frantic human want, there lies a single unified reach toward one absolute good.
And then today, in part two, we took that exact same machine with absolutely nothing magical bolted onto it, and we watched what it does when it operates at its structural limits. We watched it slip the body in sleep and brush against the truth. We watched it reach past its own skin to alter the physical world through downward pausation. We saw it climb to the absolute apex of the human range as a prophet, bringing the oxygen of the Sharia back down to the rest of us. And we saw it climb those exact same stairs the wrong way, armed as a sorcerer.
The profound beauty of this two-part arc is how seamlessly the halves rhyme into a single cohesive takeaway. The central insight here is that the bizarre dream you will have tonight, the one you will almost certainly forget by the time you finish your coffee tomorrow morning, and the blazing, world-altering vision that a prophet received millennia ago to found a world religion, those are not different kinds of events.
They are the exact same phenomena.
They are merely the near end and the far end of one single inherent human capacity. The soul's natural ability to get, however briefly, upstream of the physical body. You already use this exact machinery, a little bit, faintly, every single night in the dark. Wow. The prophets, on Alima's account, simply utilize it fully, consciously, while wide awake and relentlessly facing the light.
Which brings this entire vast metaphysical cosmos right back down to you, the listener. Because running quietly underneath both of these deep dives from the very first minute is an insistent, unyielding moral reality. What you ultimately become is built entirely by what you choose to repeat. The enduring shape of your soul is being forged right now, today, in this very moment, by where you direct your attention. The staircase that leads to the higher floors of reality isn't locked away in some mythical, inaccessible past. It is built directly into the architecture of your consciousness. It is open to you every single day through the purity of your intent and the rigorous focus of your mind. How far you climb is dictated simply by how high you dare to aim.
But as we learned today, altitude isn't everything. Becoming powerful, becoming hyper-focused, gaining massive influence or profound insight, whether all of that makes you a profound blessing to the world around you or a terrible destructive danger to it, comes down to one thing and one thing only.
The direction you are facing while you climb.
Exactly.
The staircase is there. The inherent capacity is yours. The final question this remarkable text leaves in your hands isn't whether you possess the raw power to climb the stairs. The question is, which way will you be looking when you do?
That's the real question.
Thank you so much for joining us for this two-part series. It has been a profound journey through the architecture of the soul, and we hope it leaves you looking at your waking days and your sleeping nights in an entirely new light. Farewell.